Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed especially for English learners. Today on the show, Brian Lynn has space news. And later, we have another edition of our American History program, The Making of a Nation. But first, Ashley Thompson and I have this story from Bangladesh. It was after Mohibullah scored his first political victories that the death threats began for real. On a recent morning, the Rohingya refugee spoke with Reuters in the Bangladesh camp where he lives. He read the latest warning sent over the WhatsApp messaging app. "Mohibullah is a virus of the community," he read. "Kill him wherever he is found." The 44-year-old leads the largest of several community groups that have formed since more than 730,000 Rohingya Muslims sought refuge in Bangladesh. They fled to escape a campaign of severe attacks by Myanmar's military, beginning in August 2017. Myanmar's government has ordered increasingly severe restrictions against the minority ethnic group for many years, including denying them citizenship. A new civil society is growing among the Rohingya in the refugee camps in Bangladesh's Cox's Bazar area. Some refugee campaigners are seeking justice for reported violence in Myanmar. A small group of women are working for increased rights for females. Others are simply working to improve life in the settlement that is now home to more than 900,000 people.
But several refugees told Reuters reporters that, along with the political awakening, violence has increased at the camps. They say militants and religious conservatives are competing for power. The refugees describe increasing fear in the camps, where armed men have raided shelters at night, kidnapped critics, and warned women against violating conservative Islamic traditions. The Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, or ARSA, is active in the camps, refugees say. So are several other armed groups. ARSA is also known as Araka al-Yaqin, the movement of faith. In the daytime, the al-Yaqin guys become normal people, said one young woman, who, like other refugees, requested not to be identified for her safety. But at night, she said, it's like they have a kind of magical power.
Reuters spoke with UN employees, diplomats, Bangladeshi officials, and researchers about the forces competing for influence in the world's largest refugee settlement. Some are hopeful that the stateless Rohingya are beginning to find political expression. However, there are also fears. Officials worry that a turn to violence could make solving the refugee crisis through talks impossible. Refugee camps in many parts of the world are becoming recruitment grounds for terrorists, said Muzammil Haq, the head of Bangladesh's Cabinet Committee on Law and Order. He said if this happens, it would affect Bangladesh and nearby countries. Myanmar government spokesman Za Tay did not answer calls seeking comment. Za Tay said during a press conference in January that Myanmar had protested to Bangladesh over what he said were ARSA bases inside Bangladesh.
the front line in the struggle for the Rohingyas' future are the bamboo structures where refugees take shelter from the heat and dust. In the office of his group, the Arakan Rohingya Society for Peace and Human Rights, or ARSPH, Mohib Ullah holds an open meeting each morning. ARSPH has documented reported atrocities the Rohingya suffered in Myanmar. Mohib Ullah went from home to home to try to get a count of the killings, rapes, and fires. He shared the information he gathered with international investigators. ARSPH says its main goal is to get Rohingya involved in international talks on their future. But not everyone agrees with the group's methods. Some refugees argue for a stronger position in talks about how the refugees might return to Myanmar. "We are flexible. We want to negotiate," said a senior leader of ARSPH, who asked not to be identified. "But we fear we may be harmed because of this." Arsa is among ARSPH's opponents, that leader said.
Bangladeshi security forces guard the outside of the camps to stop refugees from leaving. But violent men run the crowded camps inside, especially at night, refugees told Reuters. In some parts of the camps, those men claim ties to ARSA, said more than six refugees. United Nations officials and other workers watching the group's activities say it is unclear how many of those men are under orders from the group's leadership. But some of them reportedly have asked wealthier refugees and shopkeepers to pay taxes. They say the money will be used to fight back in Myanmar, refugees said. One refugee who volunteers as an aid worker in the camps told Reuters he witnessed a kidnapping in January by men he believed belonged to ARSA. Men with wooden sticks moved quickly into one area of the camp and took away a man who had refused to attend one of ARSA's meetings, he said. They just carried him off like a goat to the slaughter, he added.
Reuters was unable to confirm the reported incident or find out what happened to the man. Reuters was unable to reach ARSA for comment. Police have recorded a rise in violence in the camps in recent months, said Iqbal Hossein, a police official in Cox's Bazar. "So far, we have not found any link to any militant groups," Hossein said. He added that there were only 992 officers deployed to the camps. Reuters also asked the UN Refugee Agency about reports of ARSA involvement in the violence. The agency noted police reports that found most violence and threats in the camps were carried out by what they called criminal elements or related to personal vendettas.
Myanmar government media said ARSA launched three attacks across the border in Myanmar earlier this year. In February, ARSA promised to continue its armed campaign. ARSA propaganda shows the group as ethnic freedom fighters and does not suggest a position on religious tradition. But some refugees, and a report by an international non-governmental organization, say ARSA members and Islamic leaders push for extremely conservative religious behavior. Four women told Reuters they had received threats for going out to work for aid groups in the camps. Many women with jobs in the camps are experiencing paid employment for the first time in their lives. Mohammed Kamruzzaman is an education specialist with the aid group BRAC. He told Reuters that 150 of its female teachers had stopped coming to work in January after receiving or hearing about violent threats.
We sometimes hear news reports warning of asteroids passing close to Earth, with the possibility for disastrous results if there was a direct hit. But most experts agree there is only a small likelihood that a large asteroid or other space object will crash into Earth and cause great destruction. Many organizations do recognize the risk of such an event. One example is NASA, the United States government's space agency. NASA and its international partners continuously search the skies for what scientists call near-Earth objects, or NEOs. Such objects include asteroids and comets that come within 50 million kilometers of Earth's orbit. This week, NASA is teaming up with the U.S. Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, and international experts to study the possibility of a NEO hitting Earth. At a conference near Washington, D.C., scientists will simulate a made-up asteroid to explore what might happen when defending against a real-life hit. An asteroid is a rocky, airless object. Asteroids are sometimes called minor planets. They are left over from the early formation of our solar system about 4.6 million years ago. Most asteroids can be found orbiting the Sun between the planets Mars and Jupiter. NASA reports that in all, scientists have identified more than 795,000 asteroids. A comet is a small, at times active, object that contains ice. In sunlight, the ice can vaporize to form an atmosphere of dust and gas. NASA reports that about once a year, an asteroid about the size of an automobile enters Earth's atmosphere. Such objects turn into a fireball and burn up before reaching Earth's surface. About every 2,000 years, a much larger object strikes the Earth and causes major damage. However, NASA experts say an object large enough to threaten Earth's civilization only comes along once every few million years. The gathering this week, from April 29th to May 3rd, is called the Planetary Defense Conference. Attendees from NASA, FEMA, and other government agencies and experts from around the world will take part in a simulated test exercise. The tabletop exercise will consider a false threat from an asteroid invented by NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL. Groups will explore possible emergency and defensive measures to deal with the man-made asteroid threat. The exercise is based on the made-up discovery of a NEO, one that conference organizers say is set to hit Earth in 2027. The exercise estimates a 1 in 100 chance of the NEO striking the planet. NASA officials say the international community has decided that in real life, a 1 in 100 chance would be great enough to consider taking defensive and emergency measures. Organizers noted in a press release that a real-life asteroid is set to pass close to the Earth in 2029. This asteroid, called Opafis, is one of the most important NEOs ever discovered. NASA predicts Opafis will pass by Earth on Friday, April 13, 2029, within 31,300 kilometers above Earth's surface. That is closer than where weather satellites orbit our planet. Opafis is estimated to be around 340 meters long from end to end. Experts say if such an asteroid were to hit Earth, it would cause major damage to the planet's surface and our civilization. But NASA has clearly stated it does not believe that Opafis will hit Earth in 2029. However, the close flyby will provide a great chance for scientists to study the asteroid, NASA says. In the future, the world community could also decide to send a spacecraft to observe Opafis, the press release said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Doug Johnson and Shirley Griffith discuss the presidential election of 1920 and the man who won, Warren Harding.
The presidential election of 1920 was a turning point in American politics. It ended a period of social reforms at home and an active foreign policy. It began a period of conservative thinking in both the political and social life of the nation. American reporter H. L. Mencken described the national feeling this way. The majority of Americans are tired of idealism. They want capitalism, openly and without apology.
President Woodrow Wilson had suffered a stroke during his second term. He was very sick. No one expected him to be a candidate again. Yet he refused to announce that he would not run for a third term. Woodrow Wilson had done much during his administration. He helped pass important laws dealing with trade, banking, and the rights of workers. He led the nation through the bloody World War in Europe. He tried, but failed, to have the United States join the new international organization, the League of Nations. The American people honored Wilson for his intelligence and ideas, but they were tired of his policies of social change, and they did not want to be involved in international problems anymore.
Delegates to the Democratic Nominating Convention voted 44 times before agreeing on a candidate. They chose the governor of the state of Ohio, James Cox. The Republican Party also had a difficult time at its nominating convention. Four men wanted to be president. The delegates voted 6 times. None of the men gained enough support. So several party leaders met in private. They agreed that only one man, a compromise candidate, could win the support of the convention. He was a senator from the state of Ohio, Warren Harding. The delegates voted 10 more times before choosing Harding as their candidate for president. For vice president, they chose Calvin Coolidge of Massachusetts.
Warren Harding had owned a newspaper in Ohio. People advised him to enter politics because he was such a good public speaker. During the campaign, he promised lower taxes, less immigration, and more aid to farmers. He called for normalcy, a new period of peace and quiet with few changes. That is what the voters wanted to hear in 1920. Warren Harding won the election with 68% of the popular vote. In his first act as president, he invited people to visit the White House. He permitted them to walk in the garden. The act was a sign. The government seemed to be returning to the people.
Warren Harding is remembered mostly for 2 events. One was a successful international conference. The other was a shameful national incident. After World War I, Britain, Japan, and the United States expanded their navies. They built bigger and better ships. Many members of the United States Congress worried about the cost. They also worried about increased political tension in Asia. They asked President Harding to organize a conference to discuss these issues.
The conference was held in Washington in November 1921. President Harding invited representatives from the major naval powers of the time, Britain, Japan, France, and Italy. He also invited representatives from countries with interests in Asia, China, Portugal, Belgium, and the Netherlands. He did not invite the new Soviet leaders in Russia. Mr. Harding's Secretary of State, Charles Evans Hughes, spoke. He offered the conference a detailed plan to reduce the size of the world's major navies. He proposed that the world's strongest nations should stop building warships for 10 years. He also proposed that Britain, Japan, and the United States should destroy some ships to make their navies smaller immediately.
Delegates to the conference debated the plan for 3 months. Japan demanded and won the right to have more ships. But the final agreement was very close to the one proposed by Secretary Hughes. The conference was not a complete success. For example, it did not prevent countries from building some kinds of ships. These ships would prove important in the Second World War. Also, it did not create ways to protect China and the islands in the South Pacific Ocean from Japanese expansion. Yet the Naval Treaty of 1921 was the first in which the world's strongest countries agreed to reduce the size of their armed forces. Most people thought it was a good treaty.
The second thing for which President Harding is remembered is the Teapot Dome scandal. It involved the misuse of underground oil owned by the federal government. Warren Harding was an honest man, but he did not have a strong mind of his own. He was easily influenced, and he often accepted bad advice. He explained the problem with these words: "I listen to one side, and they seem right. Then I listen to the other side, and they seem just as right. I know that somewhere there is a man who knows the truth, but I do not know where to find him."
President Harding appointed several men of great ability to his cabinet. They included Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes, Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon, and Commerce Secretary Herbert Hoover. However, some of his appointments were dishonest men. One was Interior Secretary Albert Fall. He was responsible for the Teapot Dome scandal. Secretary Fall gave a private company the right to take oil from land owned by the federal government. In return, the company gave him money and cattle. The oil was not supposed to be taken from the ground. It was supposed to be saved for the United States Navy to use in an emergency. Private oil companies and many politicians opposed this policy. They said saving the oil was unnecessary.
Albert Fall opposed the policy when he was a member of the Senate. When he became Interior Secretary, his department took control of the lands containing the underground oil. Then he permitted private companies to use the land for a period of time. During that time, the companies could take out the oil. Some of the oil was in the western state of Wyoming. The rock mass on the surface looked like a container for making tea. So the area was called Teapot Dome. When the Senate uncovered Secretary Fall's wrongdoing, the press quickly called the incident the Teapot Dome Scandal. The Senate investigation led to several court cases which lasted throughout the 1920s. Secretary Fall was found guilty of misusing his government position. He was sentenced to prison for 1 year.
President Harding did not live to see the end of the Teapot Dome incident. In the summer of 1923, he made a political trip to Alaska and western states. On the way home, he became sick while in San Francisco. He died of a heart attack. Vice President Calvin Coolidge was in the northeastern state of Vermont when he heard that President Harding had died. Coolidge's father was a local court official there. He gave the oath of office to his son. That is how Calvin Coolidge became the 30th President of the United States.
And that's our show. Hope you return tomorrow to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver.